Welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 4th, 1995. In the Creekside Room this afternoon,
our speaker is Gary Coles, and he will be speaking on August 9th, a day of Christian infamy. So let's listen in on Gary.
I'm Gary Coles. This is the session entitled August 9th, a day that will live in infamy in the history of the Christian Church. On the bulletin board, or the board behind us, I've listed three dates that have emerged as peculiar examples of Christian violence on other Christians and non-Christians in the history of the church. The reason for bringing up uncomfortable history like this is that people who ignore history tend to repeat the mistakes of history. And we don't want to be like the three legendary monkeys who want to see no uncomfortable truth or hear no uncomfortable truth or speak no uncomfortable truth. That's my interpretation of that symbol. In the last 1,700 years, Christians have accounted for more deaths in war than any other identifiable group. And this of a group, a religion founded by the founder, who was absolutely nonviolent, rejected enmity, said love your enemies, professed unconditional love of friend and enemies, doing good to those who persecute us. All those endless nonviolent sayings and precepts that are obviously ignored by the church, who tends to go along with the state whenever war is declared, goes along with the demonization of the enemy whenever enemies are chosen, and basically has been faithless to the certain proclamation of Jesus, who proclaimed nonviolent love of friend and enemies for those who wish to follow him. You see the contradiction. Don't have to belabor it too much. These are very intense examples of this. How many were at the Vespers last night? So three-fourths, okay. I didn't speak very loudly, I heard, and the mic wasn't working too well. Did everybody get the gist of the Nagasaki story? I understand that was a problem, sorry. Okay, I don't have the powerful voice of a Walt Bowman.
I'm still having trouble hearing
you. Oh, really?
I have too. Yeah.
Maybe this doesn't even work. Okay, this isn't for you, is it? There's no mic. Okay, got it. Okay, well, I'll step back from this. My back is hurting anyway from dish team this morning. Before we start, I'd like to pray a prayer from Thomas Merton. Shall we pray? My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I cannot see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to love as Christ loved does in fact please you, and I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me on the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always. Though I may seem to be lost in the shadow of death, I will not fear, for you are always with me, and you will not leave me to face my peril alone. Amen. The other thing I want to do before I get started is to do my required advertisements. The only book that I, as a presenter, have ordered for the bookstore is this one entitled August 9th. It's a series of essays by Father Emmanuel Charles McCarthy, the foremost apostle of Christian nonviolence in the United States, who's devoted his 25-year ministry to spreading the truth of Christian nonviolence worldwide. He does weekend seminars anywhere in the world for no charge. He just requests that his airfare be paid for and lodging, etc., and then there's usually a free will offering. He lives in virtual poverty, has 13 children. He was married and had family before he was ordained in the Melkite Rite of the Catholic Church, which allows married priests. 9 of the 11 rites of the Catholic Church allow priests to marry. Roman Catholic is only one of two rites that does not allow priests to be married. Interesting fact. It's a bargain. It's $3.50. They only have 50 in the bookstore. I would suggest getting them for Christmas gifts for people you may feel are receptive to this message, or for your pastors or bishops or something. The essence of what you need to know, including historical perspectives and biblical perspectives, is in here. Easy reading. It's a series of short essays. It's faith challenging and faith changing, I guarantee you. And maybe McCarthy is my mentor. I've been to 4 of his conferences. I communicate with him by phone and mail at times. And he's been a powerful force in the change in my spiritual direction in the last few years. Holden is another one. Lutheran Peace Fellowship is another one. And therein lies another advertisement. The ELCA, a year and a half ago, eliminated its peace education department for fiscal reasons. And so our Evangelical Lutheran Church in America has no official peace education or peace and justice for that specific purpose in the official church. Lutheran Peace Fellowship is independent of any church organization. And we feel the burden and the responsibility for carrying out the mission of that Christ started, delivering peace on earth, good news to the poor, and you know the message. So if anyone's interested, actually, the address for Lutheran Peace Fellowship is on the back of the August 9 essay that I handed out, a list of organizations that you may be interested in. If you're Catholic, join Pax Christi. Great organization, we're sisters. If you're Episcopalian Peace Fellowship, get involved. You know, if you feel that this message is important, get involved in some organization, faith-based organization such as that, the church, and the future of the world, I think, depends on it, the sanity of the world. The church has to begin speaking out on those issues, and that's why I'm here tonight. Can't think of any better place than Holden Village to speak out on issues like this. You know, Holden is the experimental church. You know, we have the freedom to kind of test the waters here, and that's its mission. It should be always testing the edges, and peacemaking has always been at the edge of Lutheranism for sure. The Lutheran Church came out of the right wing of the Reformation. Over on the left was the Anabaptists, the pacifists, and the just war Lutherans were on the right, and that's been our heritage. Just read the 16th article of the Augsburg Confession and you'll see. Another book, one that I forgot to mention in my post-traumatic stress disorder course a few days ago, was Trauma and Recovery by Judith Herman. Fantastic book. If you want to get the history of post-traumatic stress disorder, I think some of you were here, I just wanted to mention that. It's not in the bookstore. And then the evidence of Christian pacifism in the first 300 years of Christianity is documented in the early fathers on war and military service, just documenting that love your enemies was the most quoted phrase of Jesus in the first 200 years, and they lived it. They were conscious objectors to war. Being a soldier was as outside the mind of Christ in the early church as was being a pimp. And then Night by Elie Wiesel, a survivor of Auschwitz, is dramatic, powerful message. A very short book that's in the bookstore as well. Don't read it just before you go to bed, though. It's horrifying. Then a small book that Pax Christi publishes is Jägerstätter, Martyr for Conscience. We'll take these in order. Edith Stein was a German Jew. For the first couple decades of her life, she was an atheist, non-practicing Jew. She was brilliant, a student, a PhD in philosophy, graduated summa cum laude, was a teacher, but lived in Germany. For some strange reason in the mystery of good and evil, she was at a friend's place one night and discovered a book just with nothing to do. The friends had to leave, and she came upon their library and took out a book on the life of St. Teresa of Avila, founder of Carmelite nuns and one of the saints of of this Catholic Church, and actually one of the saints of the Order of St. Martin's and Teresa, which is the other advertisement I probably should go. I'm a member of Order of St. Martin's and Teresa, which is also a peacemaker, a meditative peacemaker group, mainly Lutherans but ecumenical, grew out of the Lutheran Peace Fellowship organization. And we have as our models five Martins: Martin Luther King, Martin of Tours, St. Martin of Tours, and Martin Niemöller. And then now we have five St. Teresas: Teresa of Avila, Mother Teresa, and Edith Stein, whose canonized name was Teresa Benedicta of the Cross. Disciplines, we have three disciplines. We wear a little paper clip, the symbol of passive resistance, active resistance, but nonviolent resistance to Nazism in Norway. The Norwegian students wore this as a symbol of their resistance to Nazism. And then we try to journal every day, and we try to take a meditative walk every day, those three disciplines. And then we have wonderful annual gatherings. It's a very informal group. We also have a quarterly journal where there are daily meditations that are offered by the membership. It's a small, informal group, very loosely organized. And if you want more information on that group, to again participate in what the dire need is a visible peace movement in the organized church. Okay, Edith Stein picked up the autobiography of Teresa of Avila, and she read all through the night. She just was absorbed. She was an atheist Jew. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, she finished it, and she said, "This is the truth." And she immediately entered the Catholic Church. Wanted to get in an order of nuns, but was brilliant, and the Catholic Church realized they needed her brilliance to spread the Catholic message, et cetera, et cetera. So she wrote extensively. She became a recognized authority on St. Thomas Aquinas, did a lot of translations into German of his works. I mentioned graduated summa cum laude in philosophy. She was a feminist, Catholic feminist, far before her time. She wrote scholarly treatises on the possibility of having women ordained in the Catholic Church. I mean, this is 60 years ago. You know, she was way ahead of her time, and she was a spokesman for Christian feminism in all of Europe. She would be called to speak all over the place. A big threat to the rising fascism of Nazism, and that was her era. Her peak was in 1933 when Adolf Hitler took control as Reich Chancellor, and she was a marked woman. All of a sudden, Jews were illegal aliens in their own country. Their rights were taken away, voting rights, all rights were taken away, and she lost her job as a faculty member in the Department of Philosophy. So then she became a Carmelite nun. She devoted herself to world peace as well. That's why she's canonized in the Order of St. Martin's and Teresa. Catholic Church doesn't know about us, of course, but and so she went into the Carmelite Order, which was founded by St. Teresa of Avila, and took the name Teresa Benedicta of the Cross, Teresia et Cruce, or something, blessed by the cross, Blessed Teresa of the Cross. And so she was there, and yet she was not unknown, of course, by the Nazis. All Jews were marked. Then Kristallnacht occurred November 8, 9th, 1938, when it was obvious that the Jewish persecution was now in full force. And just a couple months later, she and her sister Rosa, who was also in the Carmelite monastery in Cologne, Cologne, Germany, escaped to Echt Holland, getting away from the intensity of the German Nazis. However, not too long after that, the invasion of surrounding nations ensued, and Holland was occupied. She and her sister were then marked by the golden six-star cross of David and terrorized by the Gestapo. They had to report to the Gestapo frequently. And then In Holland, there was active resistance and quite a successful resistance, nonviolent resistance in the Netherlands and Holland. And some Catholic bishops, as opposed to German Catholicism, where every priest pledged allegiance to Adolf Hitler and almost every Lutheran pastor pledged allegiance to Adolf Hitler, that wasn't the case yet in Holland. And they issued a letter of some sort criticizing German Nazism, and within days the purge occurred. And on August 7th, Sister Teresa and her sister Rosa were taken by the German Nazis, put into two successive concentration camps in Holland, and then put in a boxcar along with hundreds of other Jewish people. And unknown destination, nobody knew the destination, but the destination was Auschwitz. They arrived 2 days later in Auschwitz in horrible condition. The Germans, the Nazis, provided no comforts, no food, no water, no toilet facilities. The boxcars stank. It was a horrible situation. People died very frequently on the way, and they were usually overcrowded. So they often died of just being crushed, and oftentimes when they were transported in the winter, they would die, they would freeze to death. It was just a horrible existence. As soon as they got to Auschwitz, the Gestapo sent some to the right, some to the left. The ones that they thought could work or weren't subversives would often then be spared to work at the work camps or the mostly armament factories. IG Farben, the chemical giant that John Foster Dulles was a shareholder in and the representative in the U.S., used the Auschwitz prisoners to work in the chemical factory of IG Farben. But Sister Teresa was a Jew. She was a feminist. She had lots of reasons to not be allowed to survive, and she went to the Zyklon B gas chamber, and we don't know when she died. There were no records, but it was on August 9th, 1942. The intriguing thing about it is that when I talk about the Nagasaki bombing and put that in juxtaposition to the boxcars that were used, the evil, delivering evil to extermination, the plane that carried the plutonium bomb to Nagasaki was called Boxcar, capital B-O-C-K apostrophe S, named after a pilot, I believe. So there's that interesting irony. The boxcar delivered death and destruction to the innocent Japanese at Nagasaki, and the boxcars all over Germany and Poland were delivering evil and death to the extermination camps. Let me just read from the Mission of Peace.
You said that you had no records of when she died, but you...
Not the time of the day. Yeah, no question it was the 9th of August.
There were, assume that it was?
Everybody assumes that it was, yeah.
Everybody assumes,
yeah, right.
They have no record.
We don't have any record of the time of the day is what I meant. You know, we know that Nagasaki was at 11:02 and Franz Jägerstätter was at 4 or something like that, but we don't know the time of the day, but we know that it was August 9th. As her story became known after the war, there were several Germans who remember seeing her on the trip. They remember August 7th, it was stifling hot, and I think they were, sometimes the Germans along the way, the Nazis would tantalize them by throwing bread in there and just watching them scramble. They were so hungry oftentimes, and they just watched them scramble just for the sheer glee of watching them suffer some more. Or they would spray water on some and watch the people in the boxcars that were chained and with barbed wire shut so they couldn't get out, and watch them try to scramble to get something to drink. And one German Nazi remembers that, and they saw the nun, and she actually had her habit on and everything. And so there's just that documentary evidence that, yes, she was there. And she was the one that was calm. There are other people who were witnesses of the trip and witnesses, some survivors. And they noticed that she was the one that comforted the children. Everybody else was going crazy and were ignoring their kids sometimes, and the kids were crying. You can imagine the chaos and the pain and the mental anguish. And she would be the one to go and comfort wherever she could.
Do I hear you right? Are you equating what the Germans did to the Jews with what we did in Nagasaki and Hiroshima?
You can decide that for yourself when you're done seeing, you know. If you're talking about innocent civilians dying in an inferno and it's a man-made problem, you have to draw your own conclusions if this is the way of Christ.
Well, I've drawn mine.
Yeah. And please remember that there's still truth to be revealed. And a lot of these issues have been propagandized because of our interest in protecting the credibility of our own nation. You know, we are lied to with regularity through the history, you know, of our nation. We use propaganda too. I'm not saying that the United States is as evil as Nazi Germany. No, I think actions of militaristic governments do evil things. And if you were there at Nagasaki, or you saw what happened after Nagasaki or Hiroshima, you would say, "Where was God? You know, where was God, and what did we do?" There were many people, many military people that went in after Nagasaki and said, "That's the only time I've ever been ashamed to be a United States citizen." And it's true.
Sir, I can't hear you very well.
I'm sorry.
The acoustics or something.
Yeah.
But you say that she was in a boxcar and was killed in that boxcar.
No. She was killed at Auschwitz in the gas chamber, and then incinerated in the Auschwitz crematoriums.
She was in the gas chamber.
Yep.
Then the
corpse was burned in the incinerator.
And that was done by the Nazis?
Yeah, mm-hmm,
okay.
Right, yeah.
But you said in your text here it was done by fellow Christians.
Yes, yeah. The people who operated Auschwitz were, 90% of them were Christians. Baptized Christians operated the death camps and the massive bureaucracy that was required to make Auschwitz work. There were tens of thousands of people. They were earning money. That was pretty good jobs. 90% of them were Auschwitz. The Auschwitz Poland was a Christian community.
Nazis were Christians.
Yeah, many of them, yeah. The Lutheran pastors in Germany, most of them pledged allegiance to Adolf Hitler, you know. And who's to say that we wouldn't have done the same thing in their situation is something to think about. You know, we can be kind of hard on them.
What would we have done?
The people in Germany were decent people. They were decent people.
They were operating a death camp?
They were working for a bureaucratic system that was operating a death camp, yes. And they knew what was going on in there. But they each could say, "It wasn't my responsibility. I was just a little cog in the process." You know, some companies made the elevators, designed elevators to raise the corpses up to get them into the crematoria. Well, they weren't responsible for the deaths at Auschwitz, right?
So they worked there during the week and then go to church?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's right. And they were good jobs. And, you know, remember, Germany had been through a terrible depression with famine and hunger and hyperinflation. They were really in suffering a lot since the end of World War I. And Hitler came along and provided jobs in the armaments factories. You know, military economy is a thriving economy, good jobs. People are finally working and they're desperate for the jobs. There's a lot of us that are related to, that have jobs that the ultimate product of which may cause the death of innocent humans.
So that's your comparison there with the United States, that we're Christians and in our aircraft factories and
I'm suggesting that there. I'm suggesting there is a relationship, and each of us has to examine our own consciences. If we can claim innocence, if we are participating in a death-delivering product,
like
someone that's designed to kill people, Yeah, that's designed to kill people, such as fashioning the plutonium triggers or the tritium triggers for nuclear weapons. We have to each decide, is that what Jesus would do, for instance? You know, am I contributing to human suffering? Those are kind of the moral issues that each of us has to decide for ourselves. I'm making some historical comparisons, which are very valid. I mean,
but this sister, Teresa, is a well-chronicled
story. Yeah.
I mean, I've never heard of her before.
Yeah, most people don't want to hear this story.
Yeah. Some Teresa that we've heard
about. Okay. Okay, well, now Franz Jägerstätter was beheaded by the Nazis in Berlin in 1943. He was a conscientious objector to war. He was born in St. Radegund, Austria, a few miles away from the birthplace of Adolf Hitler, a few miles away from Himmler. So there were these two evil Nazi people, and Franz Jägerstätter was born just a few miles away. Kind of a ironic twist that two people who were instrumental in the massive butchery would be born close to Franz Jägerstätter. He was a devout Catholic. He was a farmer. He had several children. When Austria was occupied by Germany in 41 and 42, I believe, everybody in his community, a little isolated community, voted to join the Nazi regime, the German Reich, except for Franz. Franz was the only one that voted against it. He did his little passive resistance. Instead of providing food for the war effort, he would instead take it and give it to poor people. You know, each farmer was supposed to take a share and provide it for the military. And he would instead give it to people who were hungry. And when the German military demanded that he fight for the Führer, his family wanted him to do it. Everybody else was doing it. His pastor wanted him to do it. His bishop wanted him to do it. He says, fight for the fatherland. And he said, and he knew the gospel, and he wrote fairly eloquently, although he was not an educated person, he understood what Jesus meant in the Sermon on the Mount. And he said, you know, fool Hitler. And so he was imprisoned. Fui Hitler. Fui Hitler. And everybody else was saying Heil Hitler. He was saying Fui Hitler. He wasn't shy. Fui, yeah. Yeah, why don't you sit right here? I think this would be far better. Yeah.
So, I'm not
familiar with that. Oh, yeah. To hell with you, Hitler. I mean, he wasn't shy about his opposition, you know. So he should have been a marked man in that environment, and he was. So he was imprisoned, as most military systems abuse pacifists. He was a conscientious objector to war. His conscience would not allow him to kill other children of God, and that's pure gospel. And as all militaries do, they demean people who choose to conscientiously object to killing, and he was imprisoned. It happens in the United States. There were many deaths at the time of pacifists who were imprisoned and brutalized in World War I. In World War II, there were...
In the United States?
In the United States, yeah. Lots of stories about that. Plus shunning them. People who said, I can't in conscience kill another child of God, is not a popular thing.
Shunning.
And in World War II, in fact, Lutheran Peace Fellowship arose out of support for a number of Lutheran pastors who were conscientious objectors to war and were then taken off into camps, internment camps, and forced to pay for their room and board. And they couldn't afford it. So a number of other Lutherans got together and raised tens of thousands of dollars in support of the Lutheran pastors. That's the root of Lutheran Peace Fellowship. We have pacifist roots. We are not pacifists. All pacifists were peacemakers.
Was that the pastors who were drafted?
Yes, and they refused to serve. They refused to kill. Question?
If I remember correctly, back during World War II, conscientious objectors were not really brutalized or anything.
No, but they were taken. These were taken off in camps.
Mm-hmm. And were assigned to other jobs rather than going into the military.
That's right, yeah. I'm not suggesting they were brutalized in World War II. No.
In reality.
Yeah, that's right. So Franz Jägerstätter was in prison. He was given many opportunities to recant and join, and he refused, and he was beheaded on August 9th, 1945. a B-29 super fortress bomber named Boxcar took off from Tinian Island in the South Pacific and headed for its primary target, Kokura, Japan. He was blessed by his Lutheran chaplain and his Catholic chaplain, Father George Zabelka. But when it reached Kokura, its primary target, it was all clouded over. They had specific instructions to only drop the bomb on visual sightings of any of the sites that they were briefed on. And in the mystery of evil, it was clouded over, so they had to go to their secondary target, which was Nagasaki. Kokura, Nagasaki, and Hiroshima had been protected from the conventional incendiary bombings that had been going on for weeks and months before then. Because we had a uranium bomb that exploded at Nagasaki, at Hiroshima, and then we had a plutonium bomb. And in the interest of science, we were interested, in the interest of the military, we were interested in finding out what untouched cities would look like after the uranium bomb and after a plutonium bomb. So they had been intentionally protected from the massive firebombing that destroyed 65 or 80 cities in Japan. Those were civilian targets, basically. It's mostly civilians that were in Nagasaki, mostly civilians that were in Hiroshima. There were American prisoners of war in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Both command knew that and said, in fact, in the Hiroshima experience, they said, what about American prisoners of war? And the reply came, Operation Centerboard is to proceed. The U.S. government was aware that there were United States GIs in both of those cities, and we chose to bomb it anyway.
How many prisoners of war?
I think in Nagasaki it was like 40 or 50, as I understand, and it was an unknown number in Nagasaki. I'm not clear if there anyone knows.
There was about 250 of these Japanese immigrants.
Was there? Okay. I don't have that information. Thank you, though. So, and then when they went to Nagasaki, there was a break in the clouds, just a brief break in the clouds, and they couldn't land with this thing. It weighed tons, and they didn't know what would happen if they had a faulty landing. The thing might explode, so they had to drop it, but only on visual sighting. And the landmark that the bombardier saw through the break in the clouds was the spire of the oldest and most powerful, influential Christian church in the Orient, the Nagasaki Urikami Cathedral. And they dropped the bomb and exploded at 11:02 a.m. on the 9th of August, 1945. Nagasaki Christianity is famous in Japanese history. Francis Xavier was a Jesuit priest, a missionary who in the 16th century went to India and tried to Christianize India and basically failed. And then he went to Japan and tried to Christianize Japan, and where Christianity took was in Nagasaki. It grew and flourished, lots of hitches in there, but because the Portuguese were also involved in trying to exploit Japan. It exploited its gold and tried to take a commercial advantage of it. The Japanese soon saw the relationship there. Christianity and economic exploitation went hand in hand, and they banned Christianity. It was illegal to be a Christian in Japan for a period of 200 years. Just like early Christianity, it was a capital crime to be a Christian in the first 250 years of Christianity, punishable by death. And that was the case in Japan, because there were problems with exploitation, and the Japanese saw that, and they said, Christianity equals exploitation, you're out of here, and they were. But for 200 years, nobody knew that there was a Christian church there. It lived a catacomb existence. Christians, tens of thousands of Christians in Nagasaki were actually meeting in basements or wherever, and even without any priests, they knew the dates, the religious holidays, they practiced the Eucharist, all unknown to anybody. Japanese imperial government didn't even know that there was Nagasaki Christianity in existence. And then somewhere in the 1800s, they again allowed Europeans back into just a small part of Japan and a little island off the coast of Nagasaki, and then they allowed a church, but only for Europeans. And so the Japanese were again experimenting, letting the Europeans in, and they allowed a church to be developed at Nagasaki, but only for European Christians. The priest that was there one night heard a knock on the door, and there were five women that were at the door. And they asked to come in, and they asked him a couple of questions. They said, are you from Rome? He said, yes. Are you a celibate? He said, yes. Do you have a shrine of the Holy Mother Mary? And he said, yes. And he brought them in, and they prostrated themselves and worshiped at the little altar they had. And then he heard the story of this Christianity that had existed in Nagasaki for 200 years. And over a few years, they allowed Japanese to practice their Christianity openly again, or they tried. There was a brief bit of persecution again, and then it stopped. But the famous thing about Japanese Christianity is what happened before the 200 years of the catacomb existence. There was crucifixions of Japanese Christians, Jesuit Japanese priests. There were drawings and pictures of them, dozens of people being crucified at a time, up to 80 at a time. The Japanese imperial government would say, if look at the cross, and they say, if Jesus is your savior, then die like him, and they crucify them by the dozens. And despite this, Nagasaki Japanese Christianity thrived and flourished as in a catacomb existence. And then up until 1945, what Imperial Japan could not do in 200 years, abolish the Christianity, American Christians did in 9 seconds. The Nagasaki community was vaporized, incinerated in 9 seconds.
There are no more.
Is this the way of Christ? We have to ask, is this the way of Christ? Question. Go ahead.
Were there any Japanese Christians left, and what was their response to that?
Well, as you know, after a massive war, where the total war, where there's just annihilation of anybody and anything, civilians are not protected in total wars, they are shocked. You heard last night somebody said, well, went into Hiroshima a few days later, and they didn't even notice we were there. They were kind of nice to us. Well, after in a war zone, you are in shock, you are suffering, you got radiation sickness, you're infected, you don't have any water, safe water
was
to drink.
Was there anybody in the hierarchy there, anybody left in authority to lodge any kind of statement, a protest?
No, it was destroyed. No, since Ground Zero was the Christian church, everything around that was just incinerated and annihilated.
There must have been affiliated people.
Well, no, Nagasaki was the center and the most powerful part, and everything else was just sort of little and weak, basically. So
your point is that they used that church as a target.
Yeah, that's right. It was Ground Zero. That's what the bombardier saw.
Throughout the war in Europe, churches were used as a target. Throughout mm-hmm. Italy, mm-hmm. throughout Germany, throughout
yeah.
France,
mm-hmm.
because they were the bigger building in town.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was used as a vehicle
mm-hmm.
for the
mm-hmm.
purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
It wasn't unusual.
You're implying that the church was a target because that's what they wanted to hit.
No, well, it's just this.
There, you know that just a few hundred yards away was the largest vehicle production plant mm-hmm. in Japan.
Vehicles.
Just
yeah.
a few for vehicles, mm-hmm. army vehicles, mm-hmm.
yeah.
transport vehicles.
Yeah.
Just that whole harbor mm-hmm. was filled with munition supplies.
Mm-hmm.
That is the safest harbor mm-hmm. in all of East Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Hills on both sides. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think you should be implying that this was a target because of the Christianity background.
Not at all. I'm not implying that.
Excellent military target mm-hmm. that was key to the whole mm-hmm. military operation.
And yet it was not a target during the massive incendiary bombings in the months before.
There were others.
No, they saved it for...
Keeping this in mind.
But they saved it for the atomic bombs.
Yes.
Nagasaki, Kokura, and Hiroshima, and there may have been another one or two. They were preserving those from the conventional bombing for purposes of scientific experimentation and just to see what would happen with a plutonium bomb. I mean, I'm saying this is horribly ironic.
Before the atomic bomb, they would have saturated bombs.
Probably. I mean, they did every other major city.
Like they did the other ones, and yeah, it might have been worse than what
mm-hmm, yeah. But do you see the irony, though? I'm mainly pointing out the irony. Here was a Christian community that Imperial Japan could not annihilate for 200 years of persecution, and we did it in 9 seconds. I mean, that's a terribly ironic statement. I'm not implying, you know, I'm not really talking about the politics, although I could tell you a whole lot of things about why we dropped the bomb and whether it was necessary. And I hope everybody comes to the conference tonight, and I hope everybody saw Trinity, the day after Trinity last night. Before you make comments, you know, saying it was our patriotic duty and we had every right, you got to see the day after Trinity, and then you should also do a lot of reading. There's a tremendous amount of information out now that contradicts the propaganda that I believed for 40 years that we were justified in doing this. And now I have found truthful information.
Propaganda?
Well, come to the thing tonight. I think you'll find out. That's a long story. But
I'd like to recommend that we all read the interview with Gar Alperovitz in the latest Sojourners magazine. That's in there.
Yeah.
And also Alperovitz's book was supposed to have been published last week. He's a historian who has documented some unbelievable evidence of the propaganda that was perpetuated by the government.
What is his name, please?
Gar Alperovitz.
Yeah. Sojourners magazine is right out here.
There is a book in the...
There is, but that's not the same
one. No, there is a book. Mm-hmm.
His new book is coming out this week.
Oh,
but I heard him first on National Public Radio, mm-hmm. his interview.
Yeah, not an interview, but a speech mm-hmm. that he was giving.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's a short interview, written up in the Sojourners magazine, it is excellent. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of very good points in a very short number of pages, and his new book is 800 pages.
Mm-hmm.
It's right there on the shelf.
You know, in order for us to change our minds when we've sort of made up our mind already on inadequate evidence, oftentimes there's more truth to be revealed, and then we have to be flexible enough to say, oh, maybe I was wrong, maybe I was flummoxed, maybe this was propaganda that made me believe this. It's true that of all the pictures that were taken of the suffering and the pain and the destruction of both Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the American government confiscated all that evidence and said it's a national security matter. They didn't want us to see the suffering. In order for evil to do its work, the victim has to be silenced. In the 600 years of Christian condoned burning of heretics and Jews at the stake, those were celebrations for 600 years. And if you went, you would be absolved of your sins. They had the victims that were burning at the stake alive had to have their mouths stuffed full of cloth so that we could not hear them. That we have to silence the sufferers, the victims. We silence the victims by not writing about them in the history books. The history books are written by the victors and the oppressors. The victims never write the history books. So in school, I learned about the glory of war because the victims are silenced. Jesus was silenced. You know, Martin Luther King was silenced by a bullet.
Well,
Jesus was silenced by the cross.
And mature back in those days, that information was not kept from us because we were totally aware of everything basically that happened over there.
Well, maybe the bare facts, but not the details. Why would the American government confiscate all the photos? They did.
We saw a lot of photos.
Not all of them, no. We saw the ones that they didn't get. You know, they tried to silence that whole episode. It's true. A lot of politics.
That's what I was saying today, because I was in high school, and in a couple of years I went on to school, and there was one movie that came through within that 4-year time, quietly came through, and it was the first time we saw anything about the bomb. It was not the pictures of the victims either.
Mm-hmm.
It was just about the bomb, and it was quite a lot in itself.
Mm-hmm.
There was not a sound from anybody, our parents, our teachers, our church people.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing was mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Period. Silence.
That's right. We were silenced in the Iraq War. We just saw the pro-war stuff that, you know, there was massive resistance to the Iraqi War, and all we saw on TV, 90, 95% of it, was the pro-war stuff. And whenever the Baghdad carnage was shown, people just, you know, the military and the politicians got just panicked, and they said, "Get that guy off the news." You know, we silence the victims, or we can't stand being the brutal oppressors that you know militaries and governments, all militaries and governments are. Look at My Lai. My Lai massacre in Vietnam was not the only one. There were dozens. I've had veterans, Vietnam veterans, say there were hundreds of that type of massacre in Vietnam. We only heard about one of them, and because somebody was brave enough to say it happened. And by the way, Colin Powell was one of the people involved in the cover-up of the My Lai massacre. Keep that in mind. Question?
Yeah, I'd like to bring up another point. You brought up the Persian Gulf situation.
Mm-hmm.
I think, in putting it in a Christian context, I think it's important for us to know that, as we look back, there were 20 extremely prominent Christian theologians who went over to the Middle East in the fall of 1990, including our own Bishop Chilstrom, Jim Wallace, and a number of others, the Episcopal bishop. They went over and they surveyed the situation and came back and they went public and they said, "We have no business going to war over here." They documented the whole thing. They went to and shortly before, about the second week in January, the Episcopal bishop, George Bush's bishop, wanted to call on him. He shut the door on him and invited Billy Graham, because he knew Billy Graham was going to bless the war, which he did. He spent the night of January 15th in the White House, and the next day the war broke out. And he totally ignored all of the evidence, all of the desires of some very, very prominent Christian leaders, mm-hmm. the most prominent in his country.
I had people in my parish say, "Well, if the war was good enough for Billy Graham, I guess it's okay for me." And we never saw the pain and the suffering. We saw the smart bombs exploding. There were people, children, innocent people, who were suffering and dying and burned. And the death toll is still mounting. The Harvard commissioned a study to go over there from time to time. The latest evidence is that it's 350,000 people died as a direct and indirect result of the war. We destroyed civilian targets, the electrical plants, the food plants, the water supplies. There's no, you know, and all those things that are imperative for children to be able to grow and thrive. And we were silent. We didn't hear that. We didn't see that. We didn't want to see it. We want to silence the victims too, because we can't stand the guilt.
And you're referring to we, who are you referring to?
Supporters of, the economic, supporters of our economic policies, our political policies. You know, we vote for people who then say, throwing somebody in the furnace is okay, even though Jesus wouldn't throw anybody in the furnace. You know, that's a metaphor. Question?
I think that we try to justify our feelings of the guilt and shame about Nagasaki and about Iraq by saying children were killed, or elderly people were killed, or non-military people were killed. But I think as Christians we have to come to the knowledge that it's wrong to kill Colin Powell, it's wrong to kill Hitler.
That's right. Yeah, Jesus said very clearly, Jesus was a pacifist, the apostles were pacifists, the early church were pacifists, they were conscientious objectors to war and killing. The human person was the temple of God here on earth. The early Christians understood that. To desecrate the temple was not allowed. We all have the spark of the divine within us. Early Christianity understood that, and killing was equivalent to desecration of the temple. And besides which, they knew Jesus better than we did, and they understood and practiced love of enemies, as the church understood. I mean, that isn't to say that some Christians, you know, didn't kill, but they knew it was a sin. You know, nowadays, if it's our patriotic duty to kill in war, we don't even think it's a sin, and therefore we don't repent of it. Jesus says it's a sin. If Jesus is Lord, our Lord, we are to imitate him. We are to love as he loved us.
Back in 1944, when I was asked to go into the service and fight for my country, mm-hmm. in reality, I shouldn't have done that.
Well, that may be right, but you're a victim of the system. We're all victims of the system. Well, yeah.
I was willing to go in and fight for my country.
Yeah. Were you willing to kill for the country? Would you have bayoneted?
Okay.
And the natural extension of this is that what happens in every war, there are rapes by male soldiers. You know, that's right. Yeah, I know you wouldn't have. And there's mutilation of corpses. I mean, if you hear the stories of the people that came back from Vietnam and combat, it's horrific. You know, and you can get suckered into that. That's the natural extension, is the enrage and the vengeance, the wanting revenge, and you just go mad. And it's kill or be killed, and so you're doing unchristlike things. But it's not fair to blame the soldier, because they're just one of the massive cogs. They're the final cog. You know?
What is the alternative? If we don't have a military that is willing to fight to defend?
Well, I don't think any nation that will not have that. But the committed Christian, if he really understands Christianity and the horrible psychological trauma that goes along with killing, that, you know, Jesus said, put up the sword, he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. That's true. I know a lot of people who are suffering miserably with post-traumatic stress disorder, and the worst ones are the ones that have been in combat. They come home tormented for the rest of their lives. The mental anguish of that leads to a chemical dependency, to assuage that mental anguish, the horrible nightmares that they suffer nightly, oftentimes daytime flashbacks, you know, massive chemical dependency, and they come back unable to believe in a loving God. They've seen hell, and they ask, where is God? And nobody has the answer for them. It's a terrible spiritual problem. It doesn't affect everybody, but the ones it does, they're devastated, and it's a satanic thing when that happens. And the church doesn't really respond to that question.
Justify the Old Testament. You know, there were a lot of deaths there that were attributable to God's assistance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, supposedly.
So how do you justify that?
Okay, the best answer I have.
This.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't Christianity back then, was it? That's Judaism. The best thing I can remember is that there's a little 8-year-old girl was pondering that, and she said, I know. She was looking at the violence of the Old Testament. She said, God wasn't a Christian yet. I thought, no, that's not bad theology, you know? I mean, God was trying to reveal his plan through sinners. Again and again, they didn't get it. The prophets were there, and, you know, and finally he sent his son, who is to be the ultimate interpreter of the theology of the Old Testament, I think. I mean, I think we should, if he's God on earth, we should believe his interpretation. He rejected the holiness codes, you know, of Leviticus. You know, he rejected all sorts of stuff. He ate on the Sabbath, you know. I mean, he brought a politics of compassion, a theology of compassion, and not a theology of retribution and revenge and laws, you know. In order to get to heaven, you had to follow each of the 600 and whatever Leviticus codes. No. There was freedom. There was love. Unconditional love of friend and enemies. Non-retaliation. Unconditional love. Forgiveness 70 times 7. You do good to those who hurt you. You make your enemies into your friends. It doesn't work very well at a national level. It works interpersonally, in the family, hopefully in the church, and not even that very well. But I think we as individual Christians, if Jesus is Lord, we are to love as he loved, and that was nonviolent love of friend and enemy. It's clear in the gospel. We have been, you know, unfaithful in proclamation, word and deed for 1700 years, and we better start learning it fast, because this is the century of Cain. There's over 100 million people died in war this century. Do we think we're getting any better? You know? Look at Rwanda. Rwanda's 90% Christian. Tremendous missionary effort has gone in the last century into that, Christianizing that nation, and they've Christianized it. And they're massacring each other. They didn't learn Christian nonviolence. They didn't see what was on the pages of the gospel. And it wasn't taught. And it's largely because of the tension between our secular governments, who say it's legal to kill. You know, I mean, war is legalized murder, basically. And so they have that tension. The church, you know, wants to be, you know, in good graces, in the good graces of the state. We think if the state doesn't survive, the church isn't going to survive. That's what happened at the time of Constantine, when Christianity became a state church. The survival of the Roman emperor was then linked to the survival of the church. And so then Christians went from being conscience objectors in 311 AD. You couldn't be a Christian and be in the fighting Roman army. 105 years later, you had to be a Christian if you were going to be in the fighting Roman army. 100 years turned around. Question?
I think about nonviolence a lot, and I mean, just it interests me, but sometimes it seems like it's almost one of the laws when I think of Hiroshima or Nagasaki, you know, that say, well, maybe that wasn't so good, but then I think about nonviolence, like, as a Christian, should have the Christians tried to kill Hitler? Or is that, and sometimes I think when you were saying always nonviolence, I wonder if that turns into one of the laws, the same as don't eat meat on Friday or whatever one of those laws is. And I wonder, I'm curious, can it be nonviolent, sort of? Or
yeah. Well, I mean, it's an ethic, you know, it's an ethic, not a law, basically. It's a moral principle.
No, I'm just saying, as a Christian, do you sometimes have an obligation to kill, I guess, is sort of...
Obligation, yeah.
Right, or to kill evil. Can you make... Or sometimes it's like, as a Christian... Well, yeah. As a Christian, we need to make part of our souls black in order to make the world better.
For example, if you kill the devil,
there's a book called
okay.
Just the Lord, Just the Lord is that. Okay. I studied that in a college class that's very good.
It discusses
the very issue of justification.
The most truthful would be is to for the Christians to call themselves sort of Christians or half Christians. Mm-hmm. And we haven't arrived yet. And then that's a starting point, and it takes care of all of this that's gone before. The wheels were turning when all these people in the Second World War, the world was on the defensive, but they've been, I mean, the handwriting was there a long time. Mm-hmm. And our wheels turning now for the next one.
That's right. And now in a time of perceived peace is when to implement this stuff, because nonviolence works far better as a preventive than when you're in the mess. I maintain.
Now. We are making
that's right. That's right. Here's what would have prevented. Let me say something more. We could have. There are several ways that World War II could have been prevented. The Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I was a brutal, vengeful act by Christian diplomats who just oppressed Germany. Something terrible. It caused hyperinflation and famine, starvation, massive unemployment. We were out for a pound of flesh. We were not merciful Christians in the Treaty of Versailles. And out of that brutality, non-Christian brutality, arose Hitler. The other thing, if the German, Catholic, and Lutheran churches, which were very powerful churches, had been peace churches, as Jesus surely intended, Hitler could not have arisen out of that situation. The Christians, would, when they saw the persecution of the Jews, they would have been out in the streets doing massive nonviolent resistance, and Hitler and the Nazis could not have come to power. The Nazi Party was only 1.5 million people, about the same size as the Christian Coalition, interestingly. Okay, briefly, yeah.
Well, am I getting this right that you're saying that Christians are violent people?
Some of the most feared people on earth are Christians, yes.
We should look for another religion?
No, we should apply, we should, no, we should teach what Jesus taught. All we have to do is get back to the gospel, teach what Jesus taught. Sue wanted to ask the question, she hasn't had a chance yet.
I guess it's more than you can get, but I feel like there's a lot of my life that's bound up in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I was 2 years old when they were bombed. My dad was the Navy Stevie, and he was on Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. And at the time of the bombing, they had issued their invasion gear. There are a couple of things that have really, I feel deeply ashamed about Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and that's not easy for me to say. My dad's 76 now, and I'm very grateful I had him as I grew up. Mm-hmm. And there are really chances he would have died in an invasion. But I still feel deeply ashamed of it. And he and his wife, he's 76, has come to the point where he's willing to talk about things that were too painful for him to talk about when he was younger. Mm-hmm.